think about the incentives that are being placed on hospitals to reduce readmissions and to reduce the number of ambulatory care sensitive condition admissions, and how the dental component could be considered in those processes, as well as on the requirements the ACA places for community benefit reports that hospitals do, and how broadly we could look at the opportunity to address oral health in that context as well. So nothing shines a light on an issue such as the Pew campaign, and when the report came out on a costly dental destination, I think that brought a lot of attention to the emergency room issue and how we can sort of open up that package and benefit from presentations such as these. So Shelley Geshen will speak to us about that. She is a public policy specialist with unique dental public health expertise, deep and broad, and many years of advocacy. That's right. And where's Myron? Will need to hear that. She's advocated and pursued issues for nearly 20 years of experience working with state policymakers, looking at particular issues focused on low-income women, children, and families. And we have been just so delighted that she has spent her time and energy in the oral health arena. She served as a senior program director at the National Academy for State Health Policy, a program director for the National Conference for State Legislatures, and also worked with the Southern Governors Association's Infant Mortality Project. So, Shelley, welcome.
Thank you. So, Dushanka, sorry I was late at the beginning. We all get these little things, and if I had a ribbon at the bottom of mine, it would say it gets lost easily. I was on the other side. I saw some great ones yesterday. Troublemaker, did you see that one? Stop staring at my ribbon. I had a lot of fun with those. Nobody offered me any of the fun ones. I'd love to know how to get those. Who do you have to bribe? So I'm happy to be here. I'm not an epidemiologist or a dentist or a hygienist. I don't even use words like I'm going to go epi on you. I don't even know how to do that. I mean, I think the reason I've ended up getting some of the jobs that I've gotten is because I started my career in journalism before I went back to policy school, and I think I can tell a story to legislators in terms that they can understand. The reason why the Pew Children's Dental Campaign did this report was because over the last, some years, we've noticed a steady trickle of reports from states about inappropriate ER use and how much it's costing them. And we just thought, it would be fun to just do a search and figure out how many of them they are, because it's, if you think of the canary in the coal mine, this is it. There's a couple more. I mean, I personally also think that the costs that Medicaid agencies spend, the costs of operating room charges for kids with early childhood caries is another one. I mean, those are the two best symptoms of a broken system that I can think of. So we thought, this came out at the beginning of this year, and at the beginning of the last 2 years, we published 50 state report cards, which get a lot of attention, particularly from state press, and so the audience wasn't you folks, because you're experts and you know a lot. The audience was primarily citizens who don't understand that this is a problem for other people, and also primarily policymakers, because when I worked for NCSL, a legislator once told me he thought that there was a crisis overload. And everyone who came to him said there was a crisis. And no one ever asks a legislator for less money. They always want more money to do something about the crisis that they're coming to you with that day. But when you go to somebody with a crisis that's preventable, that's a different story. If you're spending millions and millions of dollars on something that you shouldn't be spending any money on at all, then you can get their attention. So we found 24 reports from states at that time. I don't know that I've seen new ones since then, We are going to update that report, though, and what we're going to do is call Medicaid agencies and look at the data that they have, because a lot of states actually have collected the data on how much Medicaid is spending on preventable ER visits for dental pain, and I'm pretty sure it was some of the same ICD-9 codes that that the last speaker was mentioning, but no one's collected them or published them. So that's what we're considering doing next year. The national data set shows it's getting worse. So we now have a few data points. We're not fixing it. People are paying attention, but none of the solutions have really taken hold. I think the biggest hook we have to get policymakers' attention is really the publicly insured patients. I mean, clearly, privately insured, what you're really saying, what that points to is sort of different sets of solutions and problems than public. But policymakers mostly are just hemorrhaging money in pretty much everywhere. And if they can figure out a way to save, they will. I want to talk a little bit about why this is happening, big picture-wise, and then a few solutions, not all. Honestly, I think a lot of it is just plain lack of coverage. I mean, there's a very clear correlation in the literature about, you're more likely to get dental care and have a source of care if you have dental coverage. And the numbers actually aren't that good on how many Americans lack dental coverage. They ebb and flow, though, based on the economy. As, in the recession, companies stop putting money into dental benefits, or people have part-time jobs instead of full-time where they don't offer it, so on and so forth. So it's a really changing picture. But we're not doing really much of anything right in the dental system. We don't do enough prevention. Medicaid is a mess. It's not equally bad in every state, of course. And the dental workforce needs a lot of attention. At Pew, we spend probably two-thirds of our funds on prevention and financing, and the rest of it is on research and workforce campaigns. So so we really care about about prevention. This is slightly old, but you all know this probably, but if you ever have a chance to talk to policymakers, just remind them that that if you don't provide dental benefits for adults, they're going to show up at emergency rooms, because they often Medicaid patients can get. They have medical coverage, so they think they can go to a health facility like an emergency room and get something done for them, even if they don't have dental coverage. But we pay way less than the average cost of providing care, so most dentists don't accept Medicaid, and that's a perennial problem. I probably have done more than any non-dentist to try to convince legislators to pay decent rates in Medicaid. I failed. They just don't do it. I'm not sure what we're going to do to make them address it. But I didn't remember to put this slide in, but I really wish that we had more accurate tracking of what states are covering in adult dental benefits, because the ADA, I often call John Holtze, sometimes they'll give me their most recent update, but they don't keep track of it that closely either. But it's sort of it's a constant ratcheting down. It's one of the only optional benefits states have, so when budgets get tight, they cut it. This is one of my favorite quotes. I mean, of course we're going to have people showing up in emergency rooms. I mean, the system we have now only serves two-thirds of the population. So if you're one of those people who usually are, most legislators fit in this. No wonder they don't know it's a problem. I mean, they may not have ever had a dental need that they couldn't get fixed. So if you're anybody else, you're out of luck. You're on your own. Go to the emergency room where you can't get care. So why are we in trouble? So it's not just that too few dentists are in rural areas or accept Medicaid or can take special needs kids or special needs patients or are comfortable treating children. There just aren't enough of them. In states, we've got serious shortages. Some state dental associations are willing to share that information. In others, the party line is, there's no shortage. We can take care of everything. My buddy had an empty chair last Thursday. don't worry about it. But, you know, I don't know how long that argument is going to really hold water. We also have an aging dental population. As many of you know, there was a bump of dental schools in the a bump up in dental schools in the late 70s, and so our biggest cohorts were joining the dental workforce. So they're all aging now. I mean, some of those dental schools were closed when there were when we had a recession in the Carter years, and some dentists had trouble, paying their debts and keeping their offices open, and so they pressured the dental schools to close or get smaller. So we're on another cycle now where dental schools are opening and everybody assumes that's going to fix the problem. But let me remind you of this. I mean, what we're going to have with new dentists from new dental schools is that they're going to go to the suburbs and they're going to go to Park Avenue and they're going to take care of people with insurance and ability to pay. And we're still going to have the same system problem we have now. I have not seen a shred of evidence that shows that all the new dental schools. Who is it?
I think it's a wake-up call. Sorry.
It's okay. Just wondered. Okay, so she's up. So anyway, so I haven't seen any evidence that new dentists or more dentists will actually fix our system's problems. I think it just feeds. I mean, a lot of the impetus behind new dental schools is how high the incomes of dentists are. So another problem, fluoridation. How many of you know what your fluoridation rates are in your state? I love APHA. You guys are so good. How many of you are aware of the rollback attempts in your states? I love APHA. This is so great. Well, we're getting renewed internally. I have to go back to my board to get new funds. So we collected information because I'd like to make the case internally that we should be spending some staff time and money on averting rollbacks. Foundations don't like that. They like to move forward. They don't like to hold the line. But every time a community loses fluoridation, it emboldens the opposition, and they think, see, we're right. Fluoride does cause, you know, cancer and bone loss and lead poisoning and stupidity and all the other stuff that they say it does. So basically what this shows you is, so the blue line is successful rollback attempts in the last 12 years, which is since the Fluoride Action Network and the New York State Coalition Opposed to Fluoride started doing lots of internet mischief. And there are more startups for sure, but I think those are scary numbers. I mean, if you take out 2008, which is sort of an anomaly for reasons we don't understand, it's kind of edging upwards. We're getting more and more every year, and we just have to stop that. In general, we're still making progress, but it's not as steady as I would like. So in terms of solutions, one is sealants. This is the least sexy issue in dental. As a funder and as a person who has funds for campaigns, just guess how many states have come to me wanting to do something on sealants. Anybody, guess.
None.
You're right. None. They just, you know, I don't know why, but it's an extremely cost-effective thing to do. It's just states don't seem to want it. So what we've decided to do is work on increasing the efficiency of sealant programs by getting states to remove the prior exam requirement. And this is the map of who's doing right and who's doing wrong. If you're right, you're dark. If you're the darker, the better. So if you're in the sort of, you know, the deep south, you're usually in trouble. My basic line on this topic is if Florida can make this change, anybody can make this change. And they made it a couple years ago. They just thought, okay, we see the evidence. And Virginia just did it. They did a study that showed that it raised costs and allowed these sealant programs to see fewer people. So sure, they were going to make that change. So we're working on that. If you're in any of those states with the wrong color and you want help, please call me. We're also going to work on fluoridation. We have a national campaign called the Campaign for Dental Health. I urge any of you with organizations that support fluoridation to contact me and look at the website ilikemyteeth.org. That's the website for the national campaign. We're happy to have your logo on the website. It doesn't cost anything. There's all kinds of downloadable tools. You can do what's the word for it, copycat websites if you need one for to ward off a rollback attempt or to move forward. But in the next 2 years, what we're going to focus on is what I call the dirty dozen, which is the worst, the states with the worst rates. Those are the red states. And I think of the first ones are probably New Jersey and Louisiana. We're also continuing work in a couple of other states where we were already working, and we're going to, Mel is here from Portland, and we're going to still help in Portland because although we got a 5-zip approval of fluoridation in Portland, yay, upstream public health, the antis have succeeded, I believe, right, in getting enough signatures to force it to a ballot, and so we're going to have to commit more resources to help them win that ballot challenge. So if you're in any of those states that need help, please let me know because we'll be happy to help you. Also, I do think we have to focus on the dental workforce. If we had enough people out there at enough levels, that includes experiments like the community dental health coordinator. If it works, I'm all for it. But we really need to do a better job at making sure there are people to treat or prevent dental disease so they don't end up in emergency rooms. These are a couple quotes I always want to share. I mean, people talk about quality problems or quality or fear or whatever about new workforce models, but the Institute of Medicine looked at every single available study and basically said there are no quality concerns about new models and states should just go try them, basically. And they also thought that state laws needed to be evidence-based instead of stuck in the 40s or 1950s or wherever they are. You know, the way that the state practice acts are written, for instance, related to technology or telehealth, I mean, I think the last time they were updated, the most advanced technology we had was a rotary phone. And so, I mean, think about it. I mean, I think you were the one. Were you the one that showed me an X-ray one time at a meeting? Yeah, maybe not. Okay, somebody behind me tapped me on the, okay, thanks. Somebody behind me tapped me on the shoulder and showed me an X-ray, and he was giving a consult to a person back in his office right then. None of that's reflected in State Dental Practice Acts. So we've got a lot of work to do. And the last thing I want to focus on is that we have to expand the safety net. All new FQHCs are required to have dental included, but I think the last I looked, it was something like 700 of the 1,100 FQHCs actually had dental. So what about the rest of them? What about that? I mean, this is what right now we've got a system that serves 2/3, and of the 80 million underserved, the safety net can only serve 8. So that's something that we can address in our communities, help them get grants, help them, you know, connect them with corporations that could help them with startup costs, get foundations to do loan repayment programs to get personnel in there. That's a fixable problem. We could make a dent in it. Wouldn't you rather have people show up at FQHCs than ERs? So I think I'll stop there, and I'm so happy that you're paying attention to this issue, and it's really important that people are looking in depth at their states, and thank you all very much.